session number 10421, Reel 11.
Mr. Leslie Thornton, Reel 11. About the special unit in Scotland, Mr. Thornton, what further activities were you involved in?
Well, we used to take part in a lot of demonstrations. We used to demonstrate weapons in different ways to the students. The Bren gun, we start off first. We used to go down the side of the lock, and we used to fire with tracer to an island in various ranges. Different ranges on the sights, which would show them the trajectory of a bullet, because they could see how it went up and then dropped down, which showed that the further you fired with your rifle, the higher, the longer the range, the higher the bullet went. That was only a simple one. We also demonstrated the anti-tank rifle. Now everybody seemed to be scared of the anti-tank rifle because it was a 5.5. Bullet, which was a big one, and it had a very hard kick on it. But it wasn't if it was used properly. Now, the way that we used to demonstrate, we had one of the instructors from the East Yorks, Jimmy Parton, and he was a very stocky built lad, not tall, but very strong. Now, he used to lift that anti-tank rifle up into his shoulder, standing up, and fire it. And I've seen him hit a target, a rock, at 400 yards. And then we used to make these officers do it. And of course, you could see them stagger back and whatnot. But to prove that using the right way on the range properly, it was no danger.
Was this the boys' rifle?
This was the boys' anti-tank. Yes.
And what was your opinion of it, really, in action?
Well, it was said that we didn't use it. I never used it during the war, because we had an anti-tank platoon with 2.4-pounders. But it apparently, at one particular time in France, I believe they got the wrong ammunition, because there was two types. There was the soft-nosed one, the same as a rifle bullet, and there was the armor-piercing. And apparently some ammunition got mixed up at one time, and of course the bullets just struck the tank and flattened themselves. So then the 2-inch mortar. Now the 2-inch mortar is normally fired lying down with the base plate dug in the ground and on your chest, and you hold it and at an angle that you want it. Well, we taught them to do it on the run. We carry the 2-inch mortar, two of us. One kind of the mortar, one kind of the ammunition. Then we'd stop, kneel down, put the base against your thigh, and the other chap would pop the bomb in, and I would turn the twist grip and fire from the hip. And then run further along, advance and do the same again. That saved you lying down, and then having to get up again, so that was another demonstration.
Did the kick not bruise you?
No. Well, you had to hold it against, not on your thigh, against your thigh, so it wouldn't dig in you, because it had spikes on it. But you held it against your thigh. You gripped the barrel hard and forced it there, and then all you had to do was he popped the bomb in, and he could turn the grip for you, so he could hold it more tightly. The other one was the grenade discharger cup. That was a cup shaped thing that you screwed onto your rifle, and it had two claws which clamped onto the muzzle of your rifle, and then you put the grenade inside of this cup, and you'd screw a 2-inch base plate on it. There's a little hole in the bottom of the base plug, and you screwed this base plate in before you slid it in. And then you used what are known as a ballastite cartridge, which had no bullet in it. It was just a powerful explosive. And it would then fire up to 200 yards, the grenade, where you could only fire 30 yards. But they weren't content with that in Loch Islet. They wanted some more, something else, something for it to do, extra. So we experimented. When we fired it normally, the rifle was held at an angle and put into the ground like that, and you held it at about 45 degrees. That was to get it to its highest trajectory. Well, they wanted us to turn the rifle, the rifle, of course, then was upside down. They wanted us to turn the rifle the right way up, and they wanted us to put a 4-second fuse into the grenade and fire it so we could get an airburst. So we went to the lock, we used to demonstrate, and they could see when we fired a 4-second, we gradually got in a position that with the rifle, so it would burst just above the water, so that if it had been on the ground, all the shrapnel would have gone down into anybody that was there. And of course, the trouble was that many a rifle was broken with the power, being the rifle the wrong way around. With the power of the explosive, and the butt would crack. So that was another experiment we did. There was all little things. There's another one with a rifle. We had a major came up, and he started to teach us and the students the way to fire a rifle like an automatic. What he did was get all the bolt of his rifle, but he would leave the middle finger loose, sticking out, and he would operate the bolt of his rifle, and as he closed it, at the same time this finger would come round the trigger, so he was like that each time, and he used to do it at the hip, of course, and it was for any little, let's say there's somebody hiding behind a shed, and you would run round and he'd do that, and he was a real expert at it. He could hit a chap with a rifle, and he'd fire those 5 rounds off, or 10 rounds in his rifle, in about 10 or 12 seconds. So they were taught that. And then, of course, the Bren gun at the hip. Magazine on and the legs closed and you split in and you sprayed the target with the Bren gun at the hip. Not at long distances, of course. It was used instead of a Tommy gun.
Did all these experiments work, or did you find some that didn't work in actual action?
Well, it all depended on the man himself, whether he could use it. But I don't think they were. I don't know whether they were carried out in action or not. I couldn't tell you.
But they worked for you.
They did. We actually went on. We passed an examination. On these things, with the two civilians, Fairbairn and Sykes, who were Americans, and we got a certificate that we passed on close combat, unarmed and armed, and that was mostly the Tommy gun and the pistol. Oh yes, it worked. It would have some effect.
What other things you get up to?
Well, this was a private thing. This. It was a Sunday, and the river ran past, sort of a pool in the river, and of course there was a sea trout. So we went down there, all young, PT Sergeant Major with us. We took 2 or 3 grenades, we threw them in the pool, and of course when we threw them in the pool, there was no need for us to get down, because once they got into water, the water would stop the explosion from throwing the bits of grenade up into the air. Then we waited. And we saw them, a sea trout, about 2 feet long, coming up and going down. So we said to the PT Sergeant Major, Addo, get in, he was a swimmer, get in, and we ran over to the cookhouse, Sergeant Major, just over the road, and we got a couple of great big basin things, and he threw the fish out, and we filled them. Then all of a sudden we heard somebody shout, "Ah, the bailiffs coming!" So we picked them up, took them to Sergeant's mess, took some to the cookhouse, We fed the whole camp with three trout. And then the RSM came over, and he said, next time you throw grenades in the pool, don't leave your detonator tin lying about. He had saw the detonator tin, and he picked it up before the bailiff had seen it and put it away in his pocket. But he knew what... But they weren't concerned with what we'd killed. They were concerned with the young, the spawn and all that we killed. But, of course, we didn't do it again. Well, we had a good feed of fish. A nice pink sea trout. Now I'll go on to an exercise, one of our landing exercises. We went to the end of the island, of the mainland, and we boarded the HMS Iris, which was a converted train ferry before the war. And they converted into a landing craft. And we were going to make a landing on the Isle of Skye. And the enemy were going to be the Skymen, Home Guard. Well, off we went on this ship, and we got to Skye. And he said, right off you go, into the water. It's only up to your knees. Well, it was up to our necks. So we waded in, waded ashore, and we started our advance. Soaking wet, of course, naturally. And we marched. I think we landed at a place called Portree in the Isle of Skye. And we went on, we had to march to Broadford, another town there. On the way, we had little skirmishes, imaginary skirmishes. And then we got to Broadford. By that time, we dried out a bit. And they said, right, the next time we move is 3 o'clock in the morning. So off we went into the pub with the Skymen, the real Scot, and drinking. And of course, we finished drinking, and then 3 o'clock we had to go on the move and march about another 20 miles or so. One Scotch lad who was an instructor, we halted for a rest. And he had had so much beer that when we got up to march on, there was a fork in the road. He went on his own that to the right, and all the rest went straight on. So we had to go and grab him and put him in between us and lug him along. But anyhow, that was a three-day exercise. It was an endurance test, really.
And you'd have a number of exercises in different conditions?
Oh, yes. I can't remember exactly. There were more... one particular one. A really hard one. We did Montrose's March. Now, that was a march that the Duke of Montrose did many years ago, and it was 75 miles over the mountains and roads, of course. And the students went out on it, and we went to the Lovett Scouts, and to march this 75 miles, we had to do it in 3 days, I think. And we started off, and we checked on these chaps, and eventually the time came when we came off the mountains onto the road, and the effect that the roads had on your feet after marching in the snow for so many miles was terrific. They tore your feet to bits, really. We were more used to it, so it didn't affect us as much as the students. But two or three were mentioned in the orders of the training centre, because they, rather than pack in, they finished the last 2 miles with their shoes off and the gaiters wrapped around the feet, because they were mentioned in orders for the endurance and the will to do that kind of thing. The Lovett Scouts, of course, had to go pick stragglers up, and believe it or not, those Lovett Scouts would march back another 10 miles, get hold of the straggler, and come back again looking for more. They could walk. They knew exactly where to put the feet, because we'd been out with them. We followed them in bogs. They knew exactly, and as long as you put your feet where the Lovett Scouts put their feet, you were all right. They knew exactly what to do. They're amazing blokes, really. They were brought up to it, obviously. We used to have to go on map reading exercises and find Bonnie Prince Charlie's cave. Well, I didn't know there were so many Bonnie Prince Charlie's caves in Scotland. because I'm sure we must have been to a dozen of them. And the marks on the map, you know. So there was another, and that was our map reading test, as well as the students, of course. And I think that's about all on that particular thing at present.
Did you have visits from important people?
Oh, yes. Yes, we did.
Do you remember?
I can't remember the name, but I know one was Randolph Churchill. Well, he wasn't a visitor, he was a student. And his father was then Prime Minister. And of course, Randolph came up full of importance and was told very politely that he was a student and he would do what he was told. The other one was Earl Jellicoe. That was the Jellicoe the sailor, 14 War, his son. He was a student as well. Another notable character that was a student was David Niven. He was captain then, David, and he was a comic, really. He, one weekend, he went off to London and came back, and he said, go easy, Sergeant Major. I've had a weekend in London. That was David Niven. I can't remember the generals that came up, but we did get them, naturally, because it was a place that they thought was of great importance. And so they came up to see what was going on. You had people like brigadiers who come to check the administration to see if it could be improved. Because we had nothing to do with administration or discipline at all. I mean, there's only one disciplinary, that was the RSM. He dealt with all that. We had no time. We were too busy slogging it away, doubling the rain and going over rivers and up mountains, and so it wasn't any of our business, except if you found a fellow doing something that he shouldn't be doing, of course, then you'd check him and report him.
The very fit men kind of locked away in the Highlands. Hmm. Did you have a lot of disciplinary problems on the within the...
No, you see, all in the camp, the only other people we had were the general duty men, fatigue men, more or less. Your order room staff, of course, and out of those lot, the guard was picked. There was a guard on the guard room just at the entrance of the camp every night. You had a provost sergeant, of course.
There wasn't kind of bursts of energy where they maybe fell out and had a battle of some kind of fight? Or
no,
was there
no.
Any of that going on, bullying of that kind of thing?
No. They hadn't time. They were too tired by the time they finished the day's work. You believe me. So were we, of course. But we didn't go to bed. I mean, we went straight to the sergeant's mess. We went on a beer. Next morning, we run it off. And that went for all of us.
What about recreation? Was there much
recreation?
No,
we didn't. I only played once. We've got a batch of NCOs in, and when we checked, we found that there were a load of professional footballers amongst them. So I was playing football. I didn't up there until this particular time. We went to Fort William, and I was picked up for one team, and it was two teams, and nearly all professional footballers, and I was playing outside left. I mean, you probably don't know the name, but we had such people as Bryn Jones of Arsenal up there on a course. We had Niven Hughes, who was Liverpool's goalkeeper at one time. We had Liverpool's outside left. Kemp was the goalkeeper. Sergeant Kemp was the goalkeeper. Niven Hughes was the outside left. Anyhow, I played this particular game, and everybody said, who's that chap on the left? Well, I was playing with such good footballers that the ball was placed to me, absolutely accurate. All I had to do was do my normal job, have it run up the field. I was a fast runner, and put it in the centre. And we had another Scottish professional, Dave McCulloch, I think his name was. He scored the three goals. He never said anything like them. I hadn't. One time he was facing one way, and the other time the ball was in the net. And we won 3-0. But I wish I had a photograph of that to see with the names of those people on it, of the professional footballers that played. But that's about the only time we had any sport. The only thing we did, sometimes on a Sunday, Paddy Ryan, the Scots Greys, would say, are we going anywhere? Let's get out up the mountains. So we'd take the horses, and we'd go 11 miles to a little place called Glenoig. And it was a little village at the end of the land. And in the village was the postman, the village postman. Cameron, he was, as a matter of fact, he was an ex-Cameron Highlander on reserve. And he used to have his pony, and he used to walk for the mail to Lough Island Station every day, which was 11 miles there and 11 miles back. So he used to walk 22 miles every day with his pony. Never rode his pony, and of course we got to know him very well. When we went out with the ponies, we used to ride to Glenoig and go and see Cameron. And he used to say, come in, lads, come and have a cup of tea. And we used to go in, we used to have a cup of tea, boiled eggs, because eggs then, tons of them, because they couldn't transport them down the lock. It wasn't worth eggs being transported from the little place down the lock and sent away. Because, you know, during the war, eggs were pooled. And so we two boiled eggs, fresh from the nest, Scottish scones, cups of tea. And then off we used to go back to camp, the other 11 miles. One day, Cameron was missing. We didn't see him anymore. He'd been called up.
What about leave? Did you get up?
Oh, yes, we had our leave. One of the leaves I went on, I got married.
When was this? Can you remember?
Yes, I got married on the 18th of July, 1942. I had a nasty experience coming back. When we went on leave, you had to carry everything. Your kit bag, everything had to go with you, your rifle, everything, because if anything happened, you wouldn't go back to your unit. You'd be called on an emergency somewhere else. So this particular time, I was going back to Lough Islet from Durham Station, and the train went up to Edinburgh, changed, and then went on to Glasgow. And then from Glasgow went right across the country for 6 hours to Lough Islet. I was in the train, pitch dark, and came to a station. I was asleep. And I heard a voice saying, all change. I looked in, there wasn't a soul in the train, so I said, this must be it. So I got my kit, rifle, everything on, stepped out the train and stepped out the wrong side. I went 8 feet down below with full kit. I had a green DLI green hat on, a side hat. That I lost it, but I found it. I got underneath the train. It was underneath the train. Now, if that train had moved off, I would have gone. Anyhow, I collected myself together, got up onto the station, got out the train the right side. And there was one of my mates, instructors, going back the same time. Oh, I said, thank goodness I've seen somebody. Let's go somewhere. So off we went to the YMCA, got cleaned up and got something to eat, a cup of tea, and then ready for the rest of the journey.
When you were at home on leave, did you talk about your unit? Were you allowed to? Were you told not
to?
No,
we didn't talk about it. No.
What about civilians within the locality of the camp? Did you get much contact with them?
No, it wasn't many. The only thing was your castle, your people in the cottage near the castle, the Cameron Heads, they called them. And at the top of the bank where the railway station was, there's a little pub. And we could go up there now and again and meet one or two. But there's nobody. It wasn't a village, you see. It was only a castle.
Who commanded the unit? What rank?
Lieutenant Colonel. We had one or two there. We had one colonel there who became General Stockwell, who was the... He was in charge of Sandhurst at one time. He was the Lieutenant Colonel in 1940. Then we had another colonel from the Somersets who... when I went back to my unit later on, he was commanding the unit that I joined. So I think there were about four different lieutenant colonels in that time. And your second in command, your adjutant. Same sort of composition as a battalion.
You've mentioned quite a number of the specialist officers and NCOs. Mm. Did you get on well with them all? Was there any awkward ones amongst them?
Well, not the staff. But you used to get students, majors, who used to think they could take the right out of you. But they soon got to know, because the colonel would have them straight away. He said, "You will do what my instructors say. Whatever they say, you will do." I remember one instance, it's a Sunday, it was church parade. And so we went to church, and a lot of these officers were missing from church. Well, he had them on parade in front of us. He said, "If my instructors can go on church parade, you are on church parade." He didn't have you some stick. That was the discipline on the course as far as the students were concerned. There was no need to have any discipline to us because we were carrying out a job.
Was there many failures?
No, they weren't really tested. They went through a rugged course and back to their units. There was no sitting exams or anything like that. We couldn't have done it. It was impossible. Because one lot came in and went out, another lot came in.
And all these men, as you say, were trained, and they went back to their units to train...
To pass on the information that they got at this school, yes.
As instructors.
Yes. One day, a captain came up as an instructor. And on the morning I went, and there he was on parade. And I said, "Goodness gracious, Captain Annand, VC." So we went out, had a chat, and he was so on deaf. He'd just come back from France not very long ago, where he got his VC and was deafened by the shell grenades and shell fire. And of course, the syndicate sergeant major was a one senior to me, who used to report the syndicate present. We are all in squads, and he used to go. And he went to the side of Captain Annand, Jake, we used to call him, Jake Annand, R.W. Richard, and saluted and reported. And he was standing like a ramrod, was Captain Annand, not taking a hip of the notice. So I said, "Get in front of him, get in front of him." Because he couldn't hear him. So little Sings, well, there's only little Sammy, smaller than me, out the Leicesters, got in front of him and reported. But he didn't last long. They wouldn't risk him, because he was walking amongst all the blinking grenades exploding and all sorts, because he couldn't hear anything was going on. I did have a night out with him and his wife. His wife came up, and we all went to Fort William to a hotel, the instructors, and had a chat. And he still remembers that to this day.